Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and on this episode, John Dorney talks to Declan Power about his book The Siege of Jadafil, which has recently been released as a movie by Netflix. If you want to listen to previous episodes of the show, go to our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/The Irish History Show, or Twitter, @IrishHistoryPod.
Okay, so Declan Power, we're going to talk about the Irish Army's involvement in the Congo in the early 1960s, and in particular the Siege of Jadotville, which is the theme of recent film. Can you tell us the situation in the Congo in the early 1960s?
In terms of the Congo becoming an independent state, it was going through its infancy at that point. And we should remember that its colonising power, which was Belgium, had left it in a bad state. I mean, a lot of people are aware now of the poor human rights record the Belgians had in the Congo. And it's ironic. Everybody in this part of the world tends to remember, when they think of colonialism, they think of the British. And the fact of the matter is, certainly in my experience in Africa, the former British colonies were the ones that were best equipped for independence. To an extent, also the former French colonies, although in a slightly different way. Then you had a number of other colonial powers that don't get labelled with having any baggage, such as Belgium, such as Portugal, maybe to an extent the Netherlands as well. And certainly Portugal and Belgium left their colonies in an appalling state. To put it into perspective, the new Prime Minister of the Congo, which was then the biggest state in Africa, was Patrice Lumumba, who had been a postal clerk. And that was about as far as you could go in the apparatus, a state apparatus under Belgian control. In other words, they weren't developing the native population to be able to take control of their own affairs. Like in this country, we like to talk about being colonized, but we weren't colonized when you look at what colonization was in Africa. Because we had a class of people able to, well, they didn't have to take over. They were already doing it. The civil service in Ireland under British rule was Irish rule. When the British officially signed over the books, a lot of these people just, you know, changed allegiance. And that helped normality. Now, it didn't happen overnight, as we know in our own history, but it helped us become the modern, it set the scene, set the platform for the modern democratic state we have. Now, bearing in mind our history and knowing how fraught it was at times, think about that, and then think about the Congo in the early 60s, where you had none of that grouping of people. You had a postal clerk was now the prime minister of the largest country in Africa. You had the Force Publique was the paramilitary security force that had been set up by the Belgians and officered by the Belgians. Now, the most senior rank of that organization, it was handed to a guy who was a sergeant major in the Belgian regime. He was illiterate. I mean, when we say sergeant major, it wasn't like a sergeant major in a Western armed force. I mean, this guy's job was just literally to do what his officers told him and bang the heads of the native troops, then get them to from A to B. And suddenly he was the chief of staff of their premier security service. So it's no wonder then, you know, all of the old tribal rivalries throughout the Congo started to resurface. You know, anarchy was breaking out, chaos. And Lumumba was looking for assistance. He had already looked for assistance from the UN, and they were kind of slow in responding. And he was like a ball in a pinball machine, lurching from east to west in terms of his quest to get assistance to help him stabilize this new nation that was having a problem even defining itself as a nation. And this is, of course, at the height of the Cold War. So this started to become a big issue. The irony of the Congo is that it was a very mineral-rich country, particularly the southernmost province, Katanga, which had most of the wealth. It generated the wealth of the Congo, 70% or more, depending on who you read or listen to. And the concern was Lumumba going to throw in his lot with the Russians, with the Americans, the Chinese even? He was looking for assistance from them. He didn't, yeah, he was a neophyte in geopolitics. He didn't really care who assisted him, so long as they came. And, you know, he wasn't aware of what kind of deals he'd have to make, or deals with the devil, so to speak. And it's against that backdrop, then, that the UN finally acted, created the UNA Commission, the largest UN peacekeeping mission of its time. The largest mission before that could have been classified as UN would have been the Korean War, and that was a very different type of concept. So you had this mishmash of nations. The UN sought countries, mainly, you know, third world countries, Western countries that would be seen to have less baggage in that part of the world. And this was a tall order because you needed well-armed, well-trained troops, but you couldn't take them from the traditional areas. So obviously the US and the British, red flag to the Eastern Bloc countries. So you had Canadians involved at specialist levels and staff levels in the headquarters. You had the Scandinavian countries. And then with regards to actual full troop contributing countries, you had the likes of the Swedes, the Irish, some other smaller European countries, one or two Eastern Bloc countries, and then all other third world countries. So the Indians were the best of the troops in terms of experience, in terms of equipment that were arriving. But none of these troops had ever been trained together or worked together. You had the first force commander was a Swede called General Karl von Horn, who had been in charge of the UN's truce supervisory organization in the Middle East. Now, he was a very experienced soldier, an experienced peacekeeper, and nuanced and understood the subtleties required. But when he arrived, his boss was a civilian UN official, Dr. Ralph Bunche, who was an American, a black American. And, you know, somebody probably thought that looks good for the optics and whatever else. But Bunche had no real experience in running. I suppose nobody had in running something like this. Van Horn had a degree of experience, and certainly he was a professional soldier. And he was very frustrated because Bunche was the one who had the final say. And he wanted troops deployed in a symbolic way about flying the UN flag. And he wasn't interested at all in listening to the advice of Van Horn as the chief of staff of the mission, as the force commander. But from the point of view of securing each other's lines, the different units, it was a case of just put flags on the map. And that led to fatalities. It led to blundering by the UN troops. It led to smaller parties being attacked. I mean, from our point of view, Niemba, the ambush at Niemba the previous year, that was a blunder by the UN headquarters.
Come back to Niemba in just a second. But before we do, and before we talk about the Irish deployment in particular, can you just explain what the role of Katanga was, the province which tried to secede from Congo?
The whole of the Congo was in this chaotic situation, and you had this large UN force grappling with it that wasn't too well configured. And against that, then, you had the better-off province, Katanga, starting to get uncomfortable. It had its own regional government, and it had a lot of influence from Western mining interests, particularly French and Belgian mining concerns, the most famous of which, and the largest, was the Union Minière, which was a Belgian-led, a Belgian-owned mining consortium. And there was a huge amount of minerals down there, and they were concerned because Lumumba, who is now the Prime Minister of the whole of the Congo, was talking in terms of nationalising things. He was trying to make up his mind, was he going to be socialist in nature, or was he going to follow a Western style of democracy? And it depended on who was giving him the aid as well. So in Katanga, the regional government was beefed up, we're talking about seceding, and there was an attempted coup of sorts where Lumumba was unseated from power. And around that time, General Mwasha Chambi took power in Katanga and declared that they were ceding from the Congo. They were declaring unilateral independence. Black African-led government, but with huge financial support. The irony of it is Katanga would probably have been well able to become a viable entity, but the UN didn't recognise the legitimacy of, you know, of its right to declare independence. They believed it was illegal, that he had taken power illegally, that he had rigged the election. And so it came to pass that the UN invaded Katanga. Now, they didn't invade all guns blazing. It was an unusual, but it was, you could argue that that it was an invasion in the sense that they had declared their independence. And I don't know if we were talking about having to have supranational bodies decide whether you were entitled to independence or not. I don't know, would Ireland have ever gotten its independence? But the bottom line is that UN forces were deployed down there, and there was this kind of uneasy stop-start situation. Because what had happened was, in addition to creating a government, they had their own paramilitary force, the Katangan Gendarmerie. And despite the name, which makes it sound like basically a police force, it was a military force. The other ranks were being recruited from the indigenous population. But the officers were drawn from the ranks of former Belgian colonial officers who just literally rehashed it, who were there as colonial police officers, paramilitary police officers. And they were backed up then by numerous Belgian paracommando officers and NCOs who had tendered their resignation to the Belgian armed forces. They were staying on, they were being offered contracts. And then as it happened around that time, you had a mutiny by the premier rep, as they were known, the first parachute regiment of the Foreign Legion in Algeria. And they were disbanded as a result of that. And you had all these unemployed Foreign Legion officers and NCOs, highly experienced. They'd fought in Indochina and Vietnam. They'd fought in a variety of French colonial wars. And quite a lot of the rank and file had been in the German Wehrmacht and SS and had fought in World War II. They were on hand and they were recruited. So the Katangan Gendarmerie was well-armed, was well-led, and was a pretty capable fighting force. The UN declared this whole thing to be illegal. They were using political means to try and negotiate with the government, first of all, to disarm the Katangan Gendarmerie. The government, and they were being backed in the UN assembly by the Belgian government. The Katangans were being backed by the Belgians and others, other interests. Argued that they needed military means to protect themselves from this breakdown of order that was spilling across their borders from the Congo proper and these various tribal groups that were slaughtering people.
Yeah, so one final point of context then on Katanga. Wasn't there an ethnic element to this? Because the Irish troops came in contact with a tribe known as the Balubas, or an ethnic group known as the Balubas. But one misconception I think people have is they weren't actually in favour of the secession. So they should have been on the same side as the UN troops.
Yeah, the Baluba tribe were being attacked by the Katangan-led, mercenary-led Katangan forces because they were loyal to the Congo regime. It was just down to who your tribe was aligned with. And the Baluba and a number of other tribes were pro-staying in the Congo and were taking a stance. They straddled the border area. But having said that, the other side of the coin is quite a lot of the indigenous population in Katanga seemed quite happy to be going along with independence because, you know, their living standards were pretty good compared to the rest of the Congo. And there was stability and good living standards. And that's, you know, and they were loyal to their colonial masters in that regard. Who could blame them under the circumstances? But things were quite chaotic. One hand didn't know what the other hand was doing, particularly within the UN apparatus. Because the whole operation was getting so big and the Congo was so big, rather than having Ralph Bunche and the new force commander, who was an Irish officer, General Sean McKeown, running the whole show, they appointed, Ralph Bunche's role was that, it's still exists today in UN operations. He's called the SRSG, the Special Representative of the UN Secretary General. So the UN's civil presence. So they created a new mission, if you like, or a subdivision of the mission. And they put Conor Cruz O'Brien as the SRSG for the UN in Katanga. And he had a general officer as force commander down there. And I think if memory serves me correctly, it was General Raja. It was an Indian general. And within that overall force, you had the Irish 35th Infantry Battalion. They were all based around Elizabethville. And within the 35th Battalion, you had A Company, who were the troops that were sent to Jadaville. Now, before Jadaville, there were a number of other operations where the UN troops were tasked with defending vital installations, with trying to fly the flag and increase stability. But the key thing was trying to disarm the mercenaries. And there was an operation put together called Operation Rum Punch, which was successful. There was a completely limited loss of life. But again, just to explain the lack of strategic thinking, while the UN forces, Irish included, moved in the early hours of the morning against a number of mercenary positions, took them by surprise, disarmed them, took them into custody, and these mercenary officers and NCOs were deported out of the country. Most of them filtered back in through Rhodesia, and their weapons were handed back by the UN to the Katangan regime.
As regards the Irish troops, it was the first deployment, if I'm not mistaken, or the first large deployment of Irish troops on a UN mission. How well prepared were they?
Yeah, it was the first deployment operationally of a full manoeuvre unit, if you like, of a battalion. Small numbers of Irish officers had been involved in UN observation duties in the Middle East with UNSO. But yeah, as an entity, it was the first opportunity for the Irish Army to deploy a full operational unit. How prepared were they? Well, their basic soldiering training was good in that, you know, they had good musketry skills, as it's known, good marksmanship skills. They were disciplined. They had good basic infantry training. And the officers were solidly trained, you know, well-educated in the essentials, but from a very conventional perspective. From the point of view of being involved in a large-scale peacekeeping/peace enforcement operation, they were totally unprepared in terms of tactics, training. But to be fair, most of the other countries would have been totally unprepared for that as well, because no doctrine had evolved. Mm. So this wasn't war, but it wasn't policing. It was, you know, it was somewhere in a spectrum, and you were relying on people's kind of common sense and good leadership. You had mandate that they were given, which was very generalized, which sounded great from a political point of view at the upper echelons. But when it came to smaller units of troops out on a tasking to protect an area or to protect, escort people from A to B if they came under fire, it was down to the officers and NCOs on the ground to make decisions. Also, just in terms of preparation, they were woefully unprepared from the point of view of equipment, weaponry, and the basic conditions, to the point of deploying initially to the Congo in bull's wool uniforms and hobnail boots.
Mm-hmm. And at the Nyemba ambush, which many Irish people will have heard of, 9 Irish soldiers lost their lives. Can you explain what happened there?
Basically, the Nyemba ambush happened because, as we said earlier, the Baluba tribe, who were living around this area where the Nyemba outpost was, had been badly shot up by mercenary-led forces. The Katangan mercenary-led forces would regularly go on punitive raids into the tribal areas that were considered loyal to the Congo regime, whether they were doing anything or not, just to actually show them who was boss. And their standard modus operandi was to load up a few open-top jeeps with 0.5 machine guns mounted on them and tear into an area or village and start opening fire with infantry troops, usually native infantry troops, backing them up. So it was fast, it was brutal, it was lethal, it was effective, and it petrified the living daylights out of the Baluba. I remember speaking to a Swedish officer, now deceased, Stig von Baer, well known within UN circles. He was an interpreter and intelligence officer attached to Irish battalion headquarters. And I remember he told me at an event some years back that we were chatting at, that he had met Lieutenant Kevin Gleeson, and he knew that he was being deployed to a small outpost. It was smaller than a company and larger than a platoon. He probably had a couple of platoons at this outpost. So we're talking about maybe 60-odd men, thereabouts. And Gleeson had just deployed. He had no experience of this at all. And he hadn't been too well briefed either. Gleeson was he was suffering from, I suppose, the typical thing that all the Irish were being told that were there on a peace mission. The Irish government were channeling this down through the senior echelons, and they hadn't a clue what a peace mission was. They rushed in a little bit too quickly because they were obsessed with Ireland being seen to be involved in something that was helping a new post-colonial country get on its feet, without being cognizant of what the mechanics of that would mean. And so, you know, Gleeson would have been told about how important it was to be nice to the local population and that they were there to bring peace. And they were kind of seeing themselves as military missionaries. There was a lot of naivety and immaturity at all ranks within the Irish Defence Forces at that time about what their mission was. And von Baer had warned them that the area you're going into, you should keep a low profile for the next fortnight, because these people will not know the difference between you and mercenaries. But Gleeson got orders to bring out a party of men and clear roadblocks off bridges and main supply routes. And, you know, like a good soldier, he followed his orders. The naivety bit was such that he shouldn't have done it himself. He was the most senior rank. He should have detailed an NCO. He went out with his platoon sergeant. So they were the two essential command elements of that outpost. They got to an area where they got out of their truck and they were starting to clear an obstacle. And he had instructed his men to leave the heavy. They had Bren guns, which would have been very useful in defending their position. He didn't have a security picket out. It wasn't because he was being negligent, in a sense. It was because he was taking to heart that he didn't want to present a belligerent stance. And instead, it was seen by the Baluba as probably provocative weakness. Because a body of troops that size, properly armed, should have been able to keep them at bay with their good fire control.
Yeah, look, one thing that people say about Nyemba as well, the Irish soldiers had World War II weapons. They had Lee Enfields and Sten guns, or Gustav
submachine guns, 303 rifles, and at least 2 Bren guns.
But they were faced with people armed with primitive weapons, so actually the weapons they had were more than enough for the situation. That wasn't the problem.
They were perfectly adequate if the troops themselves, particularly the commanding officer, was more tactically aware of what was happening. When this large, juiced up body of people arrive. Had the Irish a little bit of a security picket out, they would have had forewarning of this. That would have given them options. They would have been able to fire warning shots if they had the Bren guns deployed. And the Bren gun is a very effective weapon. It's called an LMG, a light machine gun. But despite the name, it has a much longer range than either a rifle or a submachine gun. And you can fire it on full automatic, or you can fire it in single shot or in bursts. A good, well-trained Bren gunner can do a lot of things, and especially if he's got an officer or an NCO giving him good fire control orders. The second thing was, aside from that, when the crowd were descending on them, Lieutenant Leeson took it. Now, it was a brave act in one sense, but he took it. It was inexperienced. He took it upon himself to go down to try and parley with them. It was common knowledge for those that were more experienced, and I'm sure Von Baer probably would have told him about this, that they were a very primitive tribal people whose witch doctors would have a lot of sway with them, and they would juice them up with them. There's a thing that we're referred to as dawa. It's a sort of medicine, and it's a combination of incantations and alcohol, you know, homemade alcohol drinks that gives them a kind of false courage, and they believe the bullets won't hit them. Now, if that's the kind of mentality you're up against, you really, you know, you're not going to go down and get much sense. He went down and infamously, you know, raised his hand and said "Jambo, hello" in Swahili to try and just calm them down. He thought, well, if once he explained who they were and they meant them no harm, and his platoon sergeant, Sergeant Hugh Gaynor, loyally went with them. But the thing was, these, you know, within moments, as some of the survivors reported, the sky was black with arrows. And both Gaynor and Gleeson, while they made it back to their positions, they were wounded and they were more or less already combat. You know, Gleeson, I think, had been badly wounded in the knee, and I'd say he was in shock. And I'd say he was trying to pull himself together to give some sort of cohesive command. But the truth of the matter was, the guys literally, they got across a river area, but they weren't being coordinated. Gaynor, I think, was probably dead at that stage. There were a few corporals. Corporals at that point would not have had anything like the same training as corporals today. And even at that, the enemy were upon them. And it was more or less every man for himself.
They were mostly hacked and clubbed to death.
Yeah, literally, I would say, were killed where they stood. And two guys survived through pure luck.
So the Niemba ambush was quite a shock to the system back in Ireland. But in terms of the operations in Katanga, they really took off, I think, the following year. Can you explain how the situation escalated in Katanga?
Niemba was a wake-up call for the Irish state, the Irish army and the Irish government in terms of realising that this was not going to be always solved with nice words and peaceful gestures. So when Katanga came about, the Irish involvement in that was much more configured to protect itself. The officers and NCOs were briefed better by their leaders. The UN mission in Katanga was keen to defang the regime and the Katangan regime, and that meant disarming, as I said earlier. So there was a series of operations put together. The tactical application on those operations was quite good. In other words, the troops used planned properly based on what their mission objective was, and they carried it out and they were successful, and there was a minimum, if any, loss of life. But strategically, the upper echelons, of which Conor Cruz O'Brien was overseeing, was not cohesive, and it was blundering, and it didn't seem to know exactly what it was doing. It wasn't being consistent. I think that would be the biggest problem. And I think part of the reason for this was the upper echelons of the UN apparatus in Katanga, in the Congo as a whole, and back in New York were confused, they were blundering. It's a problem with the UN, I would say, to this day. That's why they're not best configured to deal with major crisis. It's a good thing that now with more hard-edged military missions, they subcontract them out. In effect, the resolution, they give the, shall we say, the moral weight, and then hand it over to the likes of a NATO-led or an African Union-led force. Lightly armed, peaceful type of peacekeeping is best conducted directly from New York. But major operations like this are not a good idea. Too much room for confusion and ambiguity. So think about that. You can imagine how that was affecting the operations on the ground in Katanga. What was happening now was you had sporadic outbreaks of violence between the UN forces and the mercenary-led forces who were probing and finding weak points and gearing themselves up for a major confrontation. And there was going to be a major confrontation because at this point, Cruz O'Brien was overseeing the development of a major operational plan called Operation Mortar, which is not to do with the name of the weapon. It's the Hindi word for smash. And this was a largely Indian-authored plan to confront and disarm or destroy the Katangan mercenary forces once and for all. Which wasn't such a bad idea in the great scheme of things, although they probably wouldn't have had to be so full on if they had finished the job properly with Operation Rum Punch. But it's against that backdrop then that you had the deployment of a group of UN troops to a place called Jadaval. Now, this group was called Force Mida, and it was named after the Swedish officer that was in charge. A company group, two companies, a Swedish infantry company and an Irish infantry company from the 35th Battalion, B Company. And they were deployed, it is estimated now, because the Belgians, Henri Spaak, who was the foreign minister for Belgium and later the prime minister, and others were making noises back at the assembly in New York that there would be blood on the UN hands. It was a bit of a psychological operation. They were trying to flim-flam and unsettle the UN. That you're trying to disarm these mercenary forces, but if you do that, you're taking away the protection that the Katangan population deserve, particularly the white settlers who are dotted around the country. They'll be exposed to marauding savage tribesmen, and if there's a massacre, it'll be on your hands. So they were using every means, aside from just military means, to defend their position, the Katangans, and it was quite clever. And they were using all their allies outside of Africa, advertising and media means. They had a very good media machine in terms of managing their message and getting it out far faster than the UN. And Force Mida, when it arrived to Jadeville, it was ordered to deploy because there was this fear. Here's Jadeville, it's 80 kilometres from Elizabethville, and that this was an isolated place. We need to send troops there. They sent them there. Mida realised that the people he was sent to protect, primarily Belgian townspeople in Jadeville, who had a burgomaster who was Belgian, were hostile to them. They didn't want them there. And there was a large growing Katangan mercenary-led force, and that's who was providing their protection. That's who they gave their allegiance to. They saw the UN as the enemy. He reported this back and his observations, that he felt not alone was the mission untenable, but that the kind of ground he was in was not easily defended. So he got orders to return. And within a fortnight or so of him organising the return of his forces, Commandant Pat Quinlan, the commanding officer of A Company, a subunit of the Irish 35th Battalion, got orders to deploy to Jadeville. In fact, some of the veterans of A Company over the years told me how that en route, on the road, they passed the last elements of Force Mida being pulled out. So here you had now a smaller force, 150-odd men, being deployed to Jadeville. And as is always the case, because the Irish were not well equipped, some of their transport broke down, some of their weapons didn't, the support weapons that a company needs to properly defend itself, didn't arrive there. For example, 81mm mortars, depending on who you speak to. Some people say that they were in a truck that broke down. Others said that they never got issued with them anyway. So they only had 60mm mortars, which are much smaller. They had two armoured cars from headquarters. They would have been a cavalry corps personnel under the command of Lieutenant Kevin Knightley. These are not terribly sophisticated. They were out of date even then. They were Ford armoured cars. The armour wasn't great, but they had Vickers machine guns, a World War II weapon, used in World War I and World War II, but very effective heavy machine gun, water-cooled, in the right hands of a trained, good trained gunner. It was a very good support and defence weapon. You know, they had a full-strength company, pretty much. When they arrived to Jadeville, the commanding officer, Quinlan, you know, had never been in operational service before, but he had a good eye for terrain. He was known to have a good eye for deployment of troops, and he also had a good awareness of the capacity of different weapons. He gave orders for his men to dig in, to dig into what's known as company and defence. So rather than just billet themselves in, because they weren't in the village itself, they weren't in the town of Jadeville, they were some miles outside it at an area known as the Perfina Garage, which was like a little settlement, a little hamlet. And from a comfort point of view, they could have done what Force Mida did, just billet themselves there. But straight away, he didn't know much about the strategic situation, but tactically he knew that if he had to defend this area, his men would need to be dug in company and defence, which gives them interlocking fields of fire. It allows them project fire a bit of a distance. It gives you options. What he didn't know at this stage was Operation Mortar was in the final stages of planning and going to be enacted. All he knew was what he could see when he went into town to get provisions for his men, because a lot of the provisions that were due to be sent out to him didn't come. They had just emergency pack rations. So he went in on a buying spree with... He realised that the townspeople were quite hostile to him. People were more or less telling him that the UN weren't welcome. And certainly he paid a courtesy call to the burgomaster and was told that in no uncertain terms. He also could see, and as he had posted sentries and people were observing, that there was a large mercenary-led Katangan force in the area, getting bigger and in a state of activity. And this was going on without him getting any clear orders as to what to do or what to prepare for.
So just to sum up the situation then, on the eve of the battle, the Irish contingent at Jadeville were in effectively hostile territory, at a time when the UN was really declaring war on the Katangan forces. So they were in a very difficult position. What were the nature of the forces that went on to attack?
The build-up of forces was well noted by Quinlan and his men, and he instructed his weapons platoon commander, then Captain Liam Donnelly, who was an artillery officer, to take a jeep and small escort and go back to the Irish headquarters, the battalion headquarters at Elizabethville, which interestingly is portrayed very accurately in the film, except it has the company sergeant Jack Prendergast doing it, but it was actually Liam Donnelly. Conor Cruise O'Brien was in situ. He was being entertained in the officers' mess. He and the battalion commander left it till quite late to come out to get this update from Donnelly, who told them we're being encircled. There's a large amount of forces there. There's something up. They're not just engaging a normal one-upmanship with us. They're buzzing us. They're probing our positions. They're watching us very closely. We should be reinforced. This is Quinlan's considered message. One of his significant officers to deliver this message, to show that he was quite serious. Also, he wanted to observe operational security because the radios were very poor that they had. They didn't always work well and they knew that they were being listened to. Neither Cruise O'Brien nor the battalion commander seemed to think this was worth addressing because they felt that they were going to put Operation Mortar into action within the next 24, 48 hours or whatever, and that this would solve everything. They didn't tell Donnelly that directly. They led him to believe something was being done. And they said to him that, and this is the thing that Donnelly took as a personal insult, that if he didn't want to go back, he didn't have to. He felt his place was with his unit and his men, especially as they were, as he had reported that they were on the cusp of likely to see action. Mm-hmm. And he drove back. I think he left his driver behind and some of the men. Now, so then, to fully answer your question about the forces ranged against him at this point, he had about 1,500.
And how many Irish troops again? Just to
157.
Right, so 10 to 1.
Yeah, and that number increased. A brigade strength unit, okay? Probably, not, again, the saving grace, I think, for A Company was that this force was composed of large numbers of indigenous troops who were at various levels of training and equipment and enthusiasm for what they were there for. But a lot of mercenary officers along the lines of what I outlined earlier, with Foreign Legion backgrounds, Belgian paracommando backgrounds. At this point, the mercenary component of the Katangan forces was largely commanded by a guy called Tronchier, former French Foreign Legion officer, very experienced with insurgency, counterinsurgency warfare, psychological operations. And he would have been conceiving, coordinating and planning from headquarters. Trinquier ended up being superseded by a guy called Falquez. And he's the guy that's portrayed as being in charge of the mercenary forces at Jadeville in the film. And he's and very accurately portrayed, even right down to the scars on his face that he accrued when he was a prisoner of war in Vietnam. But in reality, the guy who was in charge, Falquez, was in charge at a higher level. Mm-hmm. He was in strategic command of the mercenary forces. He'd superseded Tranquier. And a guy called Michel de Clary was the mercenary officer. Again, former Legionnaire officer, quite experienced and adept and adaptable and versatile officer. It was rumoured, I never saw anything definitely to prove it, but that a couple of other individuals such as Bob Denard, former French Marine commando, who had ended up in prison after the attempted coup, but had got out and was doing a lot of freelance work for French intelligence in Africa, doing destabilization operations, mini coups, things like that. He was quite experienced at this stage. And there was another man named Black Jack Schramm. He was known as Jean Schramm, who was a Belgian planter. And Schramm was interesting. Now, it's disputed as to how directly involved he was in Jadeville. He's portrayed in the film as a big guy with a goatee beard who was supposed to have a bigger speaking part in it, but didn't. But what's interesting is Schramm.
Is this the guy in the white hat in the movie?
No, not the guy. No, he was. He's just meant to represent the mining interests.
I see.
And no, there was nobody of that nature that far forward on the battlefield in reality. There was nobody killed like that, but it's used as a device to explain the backing and who was who. But Schramm was a planter, a colonial planter, who who was very successful, well off and wealthy, and it was in his commercial interest, and also he would have been a believer in Belgian dominance in that area of Katanga. So he was putting his money where his mouth was, and he had financed and gotten directly involved in raising units within the Katangan gendarmerie. He would have had a lot of local knowledge, he would have had a lot of local influence politically, and on the ground, a lot of the native population would have known who he was, and he had proved himself as quite an effective leader and fighter. So these were the kind of people that were in leadership positions. That
pretty
were
tough characters, though.
Tough, yeah. Versatile, smart, highly motivated, in the sense that Schramm had skin in the game. This was where he wanted to live. He had a plantation there. De Clary, experienced combat officer. Bob Denard, an ongoing dog of war, a tool of French intelligence in that region. And all of them would have been well-blooded at that stage in terms of combat.
And again, in the movie, which, you know, a lot of people would have seen, the attack is depicted as kind of human wave attacks. Was that the way it was? Or
it's a little bit more dramatized. It made it a little bit more dramatic. But the initial attacks were a human wave. What they didn't bank on was the fact that the Irish were quite well trained in musketry. Like, you know, their weapons handling skills and their marksmanship were of a high order. The fact that they had been... Quinlan was a stickler for ongoing training when they arrived, even though a lot of it was to do with public order response in urban areas. But that's a very arduous, energy-sapping training. It improved their overall fitness and stamina. It also is all about coordinating and working in teams. So the men were very used to working closely with one another in small units, relying on taking the direction and orders of their junior officers and NCOs. They had bonded together well. The young lieutenants who commanded the platoons, the sergeants and corporals, were all well used to knitting together as a well-oiled unit. So even though they were suddenly faced with a more conventional situation, company and defence, they were well versed in this. They occupied their positions. The officers and NCOs gave accurate fire orders. Quinlan was tactically in control when the first attack came. Now granted, it was a little bit naive of them to be going to mass parade every morning. They had a chaplain. Like, it's not normal to have a chaplain attached to a company. They had a doctor attached to them as well, a guy called Joe Clunes. But this was thing, these extra things were given to them because they were going to be so far out. But you could argue it would have been a little bit more useful if they'd been given the right weaponry. It was good that they had a doctor. That probably contributed to the fact that they did manage to get out without loss of life. But in terms of the initial attack, the mercenary-led forces genuinely thought that they would rout them. They were doing what they'd done to good effect previously. Mobile jeep loads, you know, open top jeeps with 0.5 machine guns mounted on them. So a 50 caliber machine gun, it fires what's known as a 0.5 or 5 cal round, which is about the diameter of two of your fingers and the length of your longest finger and a third again. So that's one bullet that gets fired out of that. So to put it into perspective, that means that machine gun has quite a range, especially if you have it on a tripod or a bipod. You can lay down accurate fire over a distance of a couple of miles.
So they have these jeeps banging away with the heavy machine guns.
These heavy machine guns would fire quite easily through standard housing, brick walls and things like that. It would chew them up quite easily. It would blast apart standard vehicles. And they certainly would have been more than a match for the armour of the Ford armoured cars that the Irish had. But the Vickers machine guns that I mentioned earlier, heavy machine guns, they would have been a bit of a match for them. Like, you know, they were a good weapon, not quite as versatile because they had to be water cooled. But in the right hands, they would have been effective. And as I say, so these guys were advancing in kind of open formation, the jeeps leading off, trying to tear into the Irish positions, blasting away to create panic, mayhem, and breach the lines. And once they'd have breached the lines with the infantry, you know, running along, even though they wouldn't have been too well trained, but with the mercenary officers, you know, running along beside them, goading them and encouraging them along. Once they would have breached through the Irish first line of defence, it would have been all over because there would have been confusion. Instead, what happened was, as they tried to apply that tactic, which had worked well against, you know, native tribesmen and whatever else and created panic, the Irish troops, they must have been quite nervous facing their first attack, but they were keyed up for it because they had been buzzing them before. They had been driving up close to the lines. There were a few incidents leading up to that. And Quinlan and his officers would have been preparing the men mentally for this. They were at mass, and it was one of they had sentries posted. Now they weren't all at mass, and a sergeant named John Monaghan was coming from the washroom. Sentries were used to seeing these guys mass outside their lines just to provoke them. So there was no major concern. But Monaghan, he noticed something a little bit different in the way they're manoeuvring, and he felt suspicious. And he acted on his suspicions and made for one of the machine gun emplacements. So there was a Vickers machine gun set up. And as he did so, there was a burst of fire from the mercenary lines. And he could see they were mounting an attack. And he just opened fire with the Vickers gun. That alerted everybody. The Irish troops deployed accordingly. Now, again, in the film, it gives people to believe that they were all in very much a concentrated area because, you know, it's easier to tell the story. But the platoons were spread out quite a bit around this Perfina garage to give all around cover. And Quinlan would have been to the rear in the centre with his headquarter element to coordinate and get information. In fact, nearly two of the platoons didn't really see much action in that first. It was number three platoon. It was only one of the platoons that would have seen borne the brunt of most of that attack. They responded very quickly with accurate, well-disciplined bursts of fire. Well, I suppose it's important for people to understand that, you know, you sometimes see war films and you get the impression that it's total chaos and confusion. And on one hand, it can be, especially in an assault situation. It's very hard to keep control and coordinate troops, and people will, you know, blast away depending on how well or indisciplined they are. But if you're in a defensive position, it's much easier to coordinate, and you know, you would have sighted the position so that once you were opening fire, you would have interlocking fields of fire. So you're creating a wall of fire and with disciplined, accurate bursts of fire. So the officers and NCOs giving the fire orders would have ensured that there was this this wall of coordinated fire coming at the mercenary forces that would have just cut them down. And it would have been a blast that would have stopped them in their tracks. Now, this is where A Company had an advantage in that the mercenary-led forces, while I've explained some of the key mercenary officers, some experienced NCOs who were operating the crew-served weapons, the mortars, there was a French 75-gun, things like that, they were highly trained, experienced combat people. A lot of the ordinary Katangan Gendarmerie, the native forces, they were not that well-trained. They were well armed, they mostly had FN rifles, but they weren't that well trained even in the use of them. So when they suddenly, and the previous actions they had probably engaged in were against tribesmen, so suddenly they came up against this wall of fire, that would have been a big blow to their morale. They were led to believe they were just going to cut through the Irish positions like a knife through butter. That didn't happen. They withdrew after from that to lick their wounds. That was a big psychological blow. It gave Quinlan and his men a lot of elbow room and breathing space. How it panned out over the next few days was a series of sometimes full frontal attacks, skirmishes at different points of the Irish lines where they were trying to find weaknesses, and then an all-out battle would erupt, and then a period of quietness. As that went along, as they realised that the Irish were well dug in and well coordinated, the mercenaries sought further support. They had this field gun, a French 75mm artillery piece, that was brought in to lay fire down. Not particularly significant in its own right, but against a company that had very little in terms of support weapons, it was significant. Captain Donnelly's weapons platoon, which had a mixture of heavy weapons from the Vickers machine guns deployed around the company lines, and the 60mm mortar detachment, which was under the command of a Sergeant Kelly. And he'd laid out the mortars as he would artillery mortars, which are 120mm. Is not the normal way for infantry support weapons. But he told me later, Kelly, who was a well-trained infantry support sergeant, got the concept he was trying to do, where they were going to be much more coordinated, like artillery support. And it was because of that that they, under pressure, were able to lay down fire accurately on the designated area they felt the fire was coming from. And they were accurate. They hit the ammunition stash off the 75, which blew up, killed the crew. That was one less thing to worry about, and probably killed a few of the, and destroyed a number of the other mortars that were ranged against them. So that gave them, again, a further breathing space and lessened the barrage. So the mercenaries then looked for air support, and they had a little air force, which wasn't much. It was mostly fixed wing, but the UN had absolutely no air assets. They had no airframes, bar a few transport helicopters that weren't armed. Operation Mortar had commenced in Elizabethville, the main operation.
This is the UN move on the Katangan forces.
Precisely, the UN move on to disarm and destroy the Katangan regime's military forces. And Quinlan had not been briefed about this, he hadn't been told about this. His first realisation of it, I think a message came through literally to his headquarters, to his radio man, moments before the Katangans attacked his position. He had no heads up about this whatsoever. When the attack came in, then he realized that this is the context. You know, there's a major offensive going on, and I'm being attacked because we're a blip, a tactical blip that they want to take out of the landscape to have dominance in this area. I mentioned the air assets. They weren't particularly great what the mercenaries had, but the UN had nothing at that time. It was bad planning, but they were in a position. They were supposed to be bringing in Indian Canberra bombers and Ethiopian fighter jets to act as top cover for the UN forces. But to get them in, they had to fly across different airspace, and there was huge diplomatic problems because there was a lot of criticism of the UN throughout the world, in parts of the Western world, parts of Eastern Europe, as to whether this was appropriate. This was developing into what seemed to be an all-out war. Different member states were kicking up about should this be allowed to escalate. Some countries did not give permission for these aircraft to pass through their airspace, and this had to be unblocked diplomatically. It eventually was, but it was too late for the men at Jadaval at that point. Because you had one Fuga jet that the mercenaries had, which was a training aircraft. Our Air Corps had them subsequently in the 60s right through into the 90s. They had adapted them to be able to drop munitions from them, and I think they had adapted them to be able to fire, they could fire cannon. But even if they couldn't, even if the guy was throwing grenades out the window, it was still a big advantage, and it was a big psychological advantage. And when that jet aircraft strafed their positions, that terrified men. I remember Sergeant Walter Hegarty talking about it, that they were completely unexpecting of this. And that, again, it was the fact that the unit was very tight-knit, that they trusted their leadership, and that the chain of command worked. They were in a very difficult situation, and they weren't going to be able to continue to defend this position. They were running out of ammunition. They were looking for support. The UN offensive, Operation Mortar, was not going as smoothly as Conor Cruise O'Brien and General Raja had planned, as is always the case with these things. There were a number of fatalities on both sides. There were a number of instances where the UN forces killed civilians and killed prisoners, particularly the Indian forces. That's a fact. I know Irish officers that actually have gone on the record about that. And this was starting to get out of complete control. The Katangans were very quick to let this be known to the world. And this was complicating factors then for Jadaval. They fought on for about 4 to 5 days, and they ran completely low on ammunition, food and water. There was one attempt to resupply them. Bjorn Hovden, a Norwegian, and his co-pilot, a Swede named Erik Torres, at great risk to themselves, flew a helicopter under heavy fire to land in the Irish positions to give them, they had ammunition for the 81mm mortars that they didn't have, so that was useless. And then they had water in jerry cans that had held petrol, which was tainted, so that was useless. And by the time the helicopter landed, it was useless because it had been shot up. And two Irish soldiers, Quartermaster Sergeant Pat Neville and the Cook Corporal Bob Allen, had risked their lives, ran out into open space to put down marker panels so the helicopter could know they were landing on even ground. It's amazing. They were extremely lucky that neither the crew nor the two NCOs were killed in that. There was an attempt also to break through at a place called Lafira Bridge. An Irish officer named Johnny Kane was given a quick order to pull together a force. It wasn't even a unit he was in command of, to get down to cross Lafira Bridge and back up the Jadaval boys, finally. Even this had been looked for. Now, this is a tall order. It's very contentious. A lot of the troops at Jadaval blame Kane for not getting through to them. A lot of people who studied it after the fact blame Kane and say that he was cowardly, that he should have done X or Y. What they don't often stop to think about is that Kane didn't have a lot of time to plan for this. He was given a very quick order. They didn't have enough vehicles. They had to commandeer buses and break out the windows of them. He had a mixture of Irish troops, Swedish troops and Indian Gurkha troops at his disposal. Okay, it sounds great. They were all good troops in their own right, but they'd never actually operated together. So there would have been all these communication difficulties. They wouldn't have been able to deploy with the smooth efficiency that you would see now. You can imagine there was a degree of chaos. They arrived down to the bridge. There was only one bridge left. The rest had been blown up by the mercenaries. And it was blocked with barrels of concrete and various obstacles, homemade obstacles. I think it was Captain Mark Carroll, a Cavalry Corps officer, and led a brace of armoured cars to try and cross the bridge. But they got stuck. They got stuck in one of the obstacles. Came under heavy fire. Carroll, at great risk to himself, exited the armoured car to separate it from the obstacle. And they retreated back across the bridge. Kane took the decision. He made the tactical decision to pull back. He reckoned that they weren't going to get anywhere. Dusk was falling. Pulled back from the bridge. The criticism of him is that he pulled back too far. Had they stayed close enough to be able to lay fire down, they wanted to get out of the range of the mercenaries. Mm. But the mercenaries, if they came close to the bridge, were in range of the Irish-led force. Mm. And when they pulled back too far, the mercenaries pulled in closer. They dominated the position of the bridge. In fact, they came right onto the edge of the bridge. So then the next day, when they tried to push through it again, they came under even heavier fire. There was less of a chance. They resupplied. They added to their numbers and they went back to try again. Mm. Now, and on their way back, they came under heavy fire and they took casualties. The second attempt was even worse because now the mercenaries were fully prepared for them, even though there were a greater number of the UN force. The mercenaries also diverted the Fuga jet to their usage. So it strafed them as they were trying to actually make an attempt to cross the bridge and shot them up badly. They realised they were getting nowhere, pulled back to Elizabethville. They already had casualties. They got ambushed on their way back. They took a number of fatalities. It's pure luck that none of them were Irish. Said a lot of the guys on one side of the phase blamed Force Kane. They don't realise Force Kane suffered as much as they did, maybe more so. And maybe they blundered, as happens in operations, but they did try as best they could.
No Irish troops had been killed,
yeah,
which seems remarkable. But on the other side, there were reports of up to 300 killed.
Yeah.
Are those credible?
No, I think it's credible.
Mm-hmm. And at this point, when the relief failed, the company at Jedovilla more or less had to surrender.
That was John Dorney talking to Declan Power about the Siege of Jedovilla. We'll have the second part of John's interview in our next episode. Thank you very much for listening. You can hear previous episodes of the show on our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. Like us on Facebook on facebook.com/theIrishHistoryShow or follow us on Twitter @IrishHistoryPod. My name is Cathal Brennan and thanks for listening.